The massive palace ship of Nin the Destroyer, a mortal deity, supreme emperor, conqueror of continents, king of kings, rocked in the gentle swell. The waves rose and fell like the rhythmic breathing of an enormous sea beast. The ship was square-hulled, with three towering masts and two great rudders amidships. It was truly a seagoing palace, outfitted with costly timbers and exotic trappings from the various countries Nin had subdued. The decks were of teak and rosewood from the Hapasian Islands. Brass fittings, which gleamed like red gold from every corner, came from Deluria and the Belden lands of the east. Silks and shimmering samite fluttered from delicate screens on deck and in the honeycombed quarters below. These had come from Pelagia. Thick braided rope and the vast blue sails were made in Qatar out of materials procured in Cassiquaire. The ship itself had been built in the shipyards of Tarkis under the direction of master Cyphrian shipbuilders. Its makers had anticipated every necessity, foreseen all desires of the ship's chief inhabitant, and had accommodated them in ingenious ways. Nin lacked nothing aboard his ship that would satisfy his many voracious appetites. The ship rode low in the water. The slightest swell could rock it gently, but a raging tempest could not overturn it. And if it moved slowly and ponderously like its master, what of that? Time meant nothing to the immortal Nin. The Emperor of Emperors lay stretched upon a bed of silk cushions, listening to the even breathing of the sea, rocking with the slight roll of the deck. His immense bulk heaved and swayed dangerously, now tossed one way, now the next. The motion was making him feel ill and irritated. With each movement of the ship, his huge, ox-like head lolled listlessly, dull eyes staring outward in mounting misery. Nin, with a supreme effort of will, prodded himself up on one elbow and grasped a mallet which hung on a golden thong near his head. He collapsed back onto the pillows, dragging one huge paw across his forehead in a gesture of enormous suffering.
You have summoned me, O Mighty One! What is your command?
With an effort, Nin turned his head to regard the pathetic form of his minister.
Uzla! You lowest of dogs! What kept you? I have been waiting for hours! I should have you flayed alive to teach you haste!
May I say, your omnipotence, that I regret my tardiness and the blindness which prevented me from anticipating your summon. Still, I was but two steps away, and now I am here to do your bidding.
Arrogant swine! I should have you lick the decks clean with your festering tongue for presuming to address me so.
Oh, as you wish, most generous master, I will obey.
Uzla made a move as if to leave and began scouring the decks of the palace ship.
I will tell you when to go and when to come. Did I not summon you? Hear me.
Oh, yes, immortal one, yes.
Has there been no word from my warlords?
Oh, I regret to inform your highness that there has been no such word. But as you yourself probably know, there is perhaps a message on the way even now.
Nin does not wait for messages. Nin knows all, you fool.
Oh, it is my curse, great one. You would do me kindness to have my tongue torn out.
Nin rolled himself up on his elbow once more and teetered there like a mountain, ready to topple at the slightest touch.
Shall I send for your chair-bearers, my supreme conqueror? They shall hoist you to your feet.
I grow weary of waiting, Uzla. I do not wish to remain here anymore.
Perhaps you desire to be somewhere else, master of time and space. Shall I make your desires known to your commander?
I have been patient with this desolate country long enough. The conquest is taking far too long. We will go up the coast to the north to make ready to enter Ascalon, my new city. I have spoken. Hear and obey.
It shall be done, master. I will tell the commander to set sail at once.
I feel like a common thief. I would much rather lead the mounted assault of the camp.
We have been all through that, my Lord Wirtwin. Ronsard is better suited than either of us for such duty. He has experience in the Galia Wars to aid him.
I was in the Galia Wars too.
Yes, of course. However, before this night is through and before our campaign is ended, we will both be thankful for Ronsard's bold blade. I will tell you plainly that I would not welcome a ride into the camp of the Ningal.
Wirtwin trudged off to his appointed station with his men, now armed with longbows and arrows and hidden in a brushy hollow. The army of the Dragon King, such as it was, had been training with their new weapons and reclaiming rusty skills. They were now ready to try them in combat with the Ningal, and had with extreme care and cunning moved to within a stone's throw from the camp of their enemy. The archers lay hidden behind trees and bushes, in hollows of firs and within gorse hedges. Despite the grumbling which had accompanied the announcement of the proposed change in tactics, there was a tingling of excitement in the air as the men readied themselves for the ambush.
Thedo, are your archers in place?
It was very late. The moon was low in the western sky, slightly above the horizon. The knight's face shone faintly, but his features were barely discernible.
They are.
The two men looked at one another, briefly. Thedo reached out a hand and gripped his friend by the arm.
Take no undue risks. This business is risky enough.
Do not worry. Surprise is on our side this once, at least.
The Most High God goes with you, my friend.
Do you suppose he cares about such things as this?
Yes, I believe he does. Why do you ask?
Well, I have never prayed to a god before a battle. I did not consider it meet to invoke the aid of heavenly powers in earthly strife. It is man's fight, and should be settled by man's own hands.
The Most High is concerned with the well-being of his servants. By his hand alone are we upheld in all we do.
Ronsard straightened in the saddle, pulled the reins back, and wheeled his steed around.
I have much to learn about this blue god, Thedo. I hope that I may have time to learn it.
The knight returned to the place where his men were waiting, already mounted and eager to be about their task. He glanced around at all of them, checking each one for readiness. In order to move more quickly in the saddle and more nimbly, Ronsard had required his raiders to don only hauberk and breastplate, leaving the rest of their armor behind. They each carried their longswords and a small tear-shaped buckler upon their forearms. Completing his inspection, Ronsard nodded.
For honor! For glory! For Mensendor!
With that, he turned and led his men into the wooded grove wherein the Ningal lay encamped. The 15 horses and men, Ronsard's bravest, slipped into the darkness. Thedo offered a prayer for them as they passed. Then he took his place, sword in hand. He waited. The night seemed to grow suddenly still. In a moment, he heard horses crashing back through the wood.
Here they come!
Thedo raised his sword high above his head. In two heartbeats, a charger came pounding out of the darkness, its rider low in the saddle. The rider didn't stop when he reached the ranks of hidden archers, but continued on down the dale.
Draw your bows!
More knights were now thundering out of the wood, and there was the unmistakable clamor of pursuit.
Hold steady!
The last knight dashed by Thedo, but a pace from where he crouched in waiting. He bit his lip. He had not seen Ronsard emerge from the wood. They waited, bowstrings taut. Then, suddenly, the knight appeared at the opening in the wood where he had entered only moments before. Ronsard galloped into the clearing and away down the dell as the first of the Ningal came running up behind him.
Let's fly!
The first rank of Ningal stumbled forward and dropped to the ground. Their comrades boiled out of the wood behind them and hesitated, uncertain what had become of those just ahead. The enemy was thrown into confusion and dropped back into the cover of the dark wood. Almost at once, the Ningal broke from the forest, but this time they crouched low to the ground and held their round shields before them, making very difficult targets for Thedo's archers.
Get ready, men!
The Ningal were now moving more quickly over the ground between them.
Let's fly!
Some of the arrows found a home, and the shaft bit deep.
Retreat!
Thedo had seen the warlord upon his horse jump into the clearing surrounded by his bodyguard. The knight and his archers did not wait to welcome the newcomers with feathers. Instead, they jumped up and ran into the dell, just as Ronsard and his knights had done. The Ningal bolted after the fleeing archers, trotting over the bodies of their comrades. Thedo led his men down the slope and into the dell, across the small brook at its bottom and up the other side, to disappear just over the crest of the hill beyond. The triumphant Ningal dashed after them. They rushed headlong, recklessly, into the valley. Once more, in that moment, whistling death streaked out of the skies as Lord Wertwin's archers, hidden all along the sides of the narrow valley, loosed their sting upon them. Arrows hailed down upon them from every side. Ningal running out of the woods fell upon their comrades and trapped those trying to flee from the deadly ambush. Those who went down into the dell never rose again. In a moment, all who had thrown themselves down into the valley lay still. No more Ningal came from the forest. No one moved.
Let us escape now while we may. The victory is ours. If we do not long remain here, they will be back, and soon.
Ronsard gave a silent signal, and the men, knights and archers, began melting away into the night, as quickly and as silently as the shadowy clouds before the moon. Lord Wertwin's force joined them, and they left the field in an instant, leaving it to the fallen Ningal. That night, Warlord Gerd lost 500. The Dragon King did not lose a single man. The rain-washed sky arched high above, like a limitless blue dome. The air was cool and fresh, scented with balsam and pine, and the damp of earth. The grass still sparkled with raindrops, glittering like diamonds in the early morning light. The party had eaten a fine meal at Inchkeith's table, and had, thanks to the Master Armorer's sons, set off without raising a hand except to drink down goblets full of Camilla's excellent mulled cider. Quentin, well-fed and rested, had quite forgotten his apprehension of the night before. He had convinced himself that his arm was better and that it would surely fully heal. But he still could not see how he could be expected to wield a sword before his bones had knit. Thus, the awesome prospect of his being the mysterious legendary priest king seemed remote and almost ridiculous. In the dazzle of a brilliant new day, he felt ashamed and embarrassed for having had the audacity of presuming himself to be in any way central to the fulfilling of the prophecy. Of course, it had been a presumption fostered by both Durwin, Bjorkus, and for all Quentin knew, Tolly. But he had allowed them to lead him into thinking that the prophecy might indeed point to him. The whole thing was foolish, preposterous. Quentin could see that now. He told himself so, and he believed it. The horses had clattered out of Whitehall's courtyard at first light. Through the cleft in the ridge wall, golden rays of sunlight sliced the violet shadow of the canyon like a blade. It appeared to Quentin as they rode through the gatehouse and out onto the broad meadow that they moved upon a trail of light, all golden and green and shimmering. Everything that came to view, every tree and rock and mountain peak, seemed clean and new and vibrant with life. It was as if the world had been created anew during the night, and the old world had been cast off as a pale, pathetic parody of the true thing. Quentin imagined that he was seeing it all for the first time, and that this was how it had looked when the world was young. Quentin turned to see Derwin's face, radiant in the golden light, mouth open and head thrown back, and then suddenly, he felt joyous as well. Beside them, as they neared the cleft, the rock stream cascaded with renewed vigor, leaping over its stony bed and splashing fiery gems into the air. The stream, called Rock Race by Inchkeith, spread out a road of flowing silver as it rushed to meet the day. They followed Rock Race for a long time among the fragrant firs, and then, as the sun mounted higher, crossed it and headed toward the Fiskill's barren foothills.
How far from here are the Lost Mines?
Derwin rode just ahead. He cast a backward look over his shoulder.
If anyone knew that, my friend, there would be no need of going. The Lanthanil would be long gone by now.
You know what I mean, you old sorcerer.
So it is. How impatient you are. I think that before 10 suns have set, we will look upon the entrance to the lost mines of the Auriga. That is, if the mountains are not greatly altered since those maps were made. Just the same, it will be no easy task to find them.
We have the riddle.
Yes, there is that. But you know as well as I that riddles are meant to conceal as much as they reveal. We will have a time of it, I think. The Most High will have to show us very plainly.
Inchkeith had been listening and now turned toward them.
You know, Derwin, The first time we met, you were gabbling about those lost mines of yours. You were full of questions about the Lanthanil. You wanted to know if I had ever seen it or worked with it. You remember?
I remember it well. And I also remember your answer, though you may not. You looked at me with the greatest pity and said, if I had ever touched the metal of the gods, do you think I would still wear the cloak of a hunchback?
Oh, mine was a foolish question, I admit. But you must remember, I had only just discovered the existence of Lanthanil and knew nothing of its full properties. Craftsmen like myself have our own tales of Lanthanil, though how much truth is in them I cannot tell.
I have on rare occasions heard the elders speak of Lanthanil. To the Aragar it was prized more highly than gold or silver. The craftsmen who worked it were almost treated as priests. But I never heard it referred to as a healing agent.
Cohen Navish.
Quentin turned to see that Tolly had dropped back and was now riding beside him, intent upon the conversation.
Yes, the healing stones.
Can you not guess the answer?
Quentin frowned and thought, and at last shrugged.
Well, think but a moment. The Aragar had no need of healing from any ailment. They lived in perfect health and never fell to disease, and none were ever reported to have been injured in any way. Healing is not mentioned as a property of the stone, though they probably knew about it if Toli's story is true. Its healing properties were seldom mentioned because they had no need of it for themselves. As for the craftsmen being priests, they were of a sort. They were poets, you might say. They worked in metal, wood, and stone as our poets work with words. And to the Aragar, it was reckoned as almost the same thing. I say almost because the Aragar rejoiced in a thing well made. For even in the smallest utensils of everyday life, they saw the face of the Most High. So craftsmen were priests in that they allowed the people to see something of their God in the objects around them. And they were greatly respected.
No more was spoken for a long time. Quentin rode along and thought about Dekra and realized he missed his friends there. He wondered what they were doing and whether they missed him as well. He also wondered what Yesef would say if he knew that his protege was now embarked upon a quest for the lost mines of the Aragar. What would Yesef say if he knew Quentin was to play a role in the forging of the Zalakir? Escavar slouched in his throne-like chair. His gaunt visage showed his displeasure quite openly. The lords of Mensendor, now gathered before him, clenched their fists at their sides and scowled determinedly.
Where are the others, my lords? Do they propose to sit round the field and join in the slaughter with whichever side carries the day?
Lord Beniot was the first man to speak.
We know not what other lords propose to do, sire, but we have come to offer you our swords and those of our knights. We will ride with the Dragon King.
To the death, if need be. By Azrael, I will not see my king do battle alone while I have a blade beside me. My men are yours, sire.
And mine!
Well done, my lords.
Though Escavar did well appreciate the decision of these his loyal nobles, the king was inflamed against a sizable party led by Amaronus and Lupolin, who had, after 2 days of heated contention, remained unmoved in their decision to withhold support for what they considered the King's War.
We will go at once to muster and arm our troops. We will march hence as soon as may be.
Lord Fincher placed his hand to the hilt of his short sword as he spoke.
It will be a pleasure to ride beside the Dragon King again.
It will be no pleasure, my lords. Make no mistake. I believe this will be the utmost test of our might and endurance. If we fail, the world will grow dark. Freedom will die.
Then let us fly, your majesty. We will return in 3 days, and we will march out with you to meet Thedor and Ransard and Wertwin's men in the field.
Yes, fly at once. And remember, my lords, spare nothing. If we fail, there will be nothing left worth claiming in the end. I will speak again to the others to see if my words may yet prevail upon them to change their decision. We will need every strong arm before this war is over, I fear. Be on your way. I will await you here, ready to march at once.
When the gathered nobles had gone, Escobar called for Oswald.
Fetch me the armorer. I will speak with him at once.
Oswald appeared doubtful and frowned deeply, his old features crinkling up into a web of lines and creases.
Do not look at me so! Fetch the armor at once, I say!
Without reply, the Chamberlain bowed and went out. Oswald came back in, followed by a swarthy man with muscles that bulged and rippled as he moved.
Tilbert, sire!
Oswald presented the man and left without looking at the king.
Tilbert!
The man nodded and remained at attention, his face stern and alert.
Ready my armor and my weapons. I will need both soon, within 3 days. Ready yourself and any tools you think best. You will be needing them.
At that moment, the chamber door swung open without a knock, and Queen Alenia came into the room. Tilbert bowed to the queen.
My lord, why is this man here?
I am speaking with him.
And about what, I can guess. My husband, certainly you do not entertain any false notions of going into battle.
The king moved to dismiss Tilbert with a quick wave of his hand. The armorer bowed from the waist and started out.
Wait!
Alenia turned once more to the king and fixed him with a smoldering stare.
Derwin is gone, and so you think that you may now do as you please? Is that it? You are still very weak, Escavar. Think of your health.
You may go now, Tilbert.
The man left the chamber quietly. Alenia crossed to the king's chair and fell to her knees beside Escavar, seizing his right hand in both of hers.
I pray you, my king, do not go! It will be the death of you!
That rascal Oswald told you!
What does it matter? My darling, you are just up from your sickbed and you have not your full strength. Wait at least until you feel stronger.
Escavar put a hand to her lovely head and laced his fingers in her hair.
My lady, I would that I could stay, but I cannot, nor can I wait one day longer than it takes to assemble my army to march.
But why? Let your lord serve you in this. Thedo and Ronsard would tell you the same if they were here. They are on the field now. Let them assume command.
It may not be. The larger part of the council still opposes the call to arms that I have sounded. They are not convinced there is sufficient reason for them to march in war upon the whim of their raving monarch. Do you not see? They believe me ill and troubled of mind. They think I joust at shadows. I must go out ahead of my army and convince them I am fit to command and that my judgment is unimpaired. Maybe then they will join us. I pray they do before it is too late.
But is there no other way?
I must go. It is the only hope we have.
Oh, my lord. It is an evil day that takes you from me thus.
That it is, my queen. Most assuredly it is.
The Wolf Star could be seen glinting cold and bright as soon as the sun slipped below the western rim of the sky. It rose before the other stars and set last of all. The people of Mensendor, if they had not noticed it before, now were wary of it. Doomsayers went from city to city, spreading rumors of death and destruction and prophesying the end of the age. The weak-minded believed these rumors and fled to the temples, seeking the shelter of sacred soil where the gods would protect them. More stout-hearted citizens stood their ground and waited and watched. But all listened to the wind and paused in their daily tasks to lift their eyes to the far horizon, as if they expected at any moment the approach of something they dared not name aloud. Thedo and Ronsard, having weakened the army of Warlord Gerd, turned their attention to the army of Warlord Luhak, who was advancing at a fast pace to the north. Arriving late at night, having traveled 10 leagues that day with little rest, the king's forces struck once more on their midnight raid. Once again they caught the enemy by surprise and slew many. On the next attempt, however, a confused signal almost defeated the Dragon King's army. The Warlord's troops were waiting in a wooded draw, and Ronsard's knights met them. Before Ronsard and company could disengage and break free, the archers attacked, and many good men fell by friendly hands. The King's men withdrew from the field, leaving the Ningal exultant. As for Quentin and his party, the four ascended the empty foothills of the Ragged Mountains and labored up into the dismal heights. The way proved slow and difficult, even with sure-footed animals and Derwin's knowledge of the more passable routes. They lost their way and spent 3 arduous days crossing and recrossing the same trail, and finally gave up, camping that night in the same spot where they had camped 3 nights before. One of the pack animals threw a shoe straining over the rocks and had to be set free. Many supplies were abandoned in order not to overburden the remaining animals. The dark cloud had deepened its shadow over the land. Mensendor seemed to be a country quivering on the edge of the abyss. The roads were filled by day with travelers hurrying from here to there in an effort to find escape. The temple courtyards became choked with peasants seeking sanctuary. At the high temple above Naramore, the trail leading to the temple had blossomed into a tent city from the base of the plateau to its crown. All along its narrow length, people huddled in their tents and waited for what they had been told would come: the destroyer god, descending to earth to slake his thirst with their blood. And each night, all over Mensendor, men watched the star grow brighter and cowered in fear at the impending destruction thus proclaimed. Steadily, despite Thedos and Ronsard's best efforts and most valiant and courageous fighting, the Ningal drove further north toward Ascalon. The king's knights were solidly outnumbered, and the enemy soon grew wary of the crafty defender's tricks, becoming more and more difficult to lure into traps and ambushes. On and on the enemy pushed, and at last achieved the very thing the Dragon King's army feared the most. The 4 warlords joined their forces. The soldiers of Bogaz and Ahmut forged through to meet Gerd's remnant and Luhat's fairly intact regiment at the outer fringes of Pelgrin Forest. No invader had ever pushed so far inland in recent memory. No enemy had ever defied the Dragon King's knights as did the Ningal, whose combined forces shamed the stalwart defenders. Under Mirmior's inspired strategy, the Dragon King's army fell back into the forest to wage a war of ambush and retreat among the paths they knew so well. This increased the rage of the enemy, and that rage induced him to make mistakes and lose men. But the relentless push to Ascalon continued, slowly and surely and with mechanical precision. It seemed as if nothing would stop the cunning invader.
We cannot continue this way.
It was the end of another long day of sting and run among the oaks of Pelgrin. The commander sat in Ronsard's tent, ashen-faced in the fluttering torchlight.
We are giving up too much ground, even though our losses in men are lower than we could have hoped, thanks to Mirmior. I think it is time we send word to Ascalon for the king to make ready for a siege. Though I hoped it would not come to this, they should begin preparing the castle for our return.
It would seem that in time we could beat these Ningal, if we but had more men. Could we not send Wertwin to the other lords to entreat them to take up arms? Now is the time, if ever there was. They cannot fail to recognize the danger now.
I quite agree with you, brave sir. But I hold no hopes for persuading those jackals to join us. They have had every opportunity. Why, we are but 10 leagues from Ascalon now.
Even so, allow me to ride to Amaronus and the others. They are not cowardly men, and will be reasonable once they know the need. I will bring them around.
Go then, my lord. Do what you can. But go with all speed. There is little time left. Each day we are pushed further back.
The nobleman stood, weary to the marrow, and reeling on his feet.
I will leave tonight, and take but 2 of my own with me. The others I will place under Ronsard's command.
With a quick bow, he left, and the others returned once more to their nightly exercise, led by Mirmior, who listened intently to the reports of the day's forays, and then applied himself to creating some new strategy for the next day. He seemed to have a gift for anticipating the movements of the enemy, and for diversions and surprises which allowed the king's men to hound and harry the plotting Ningal.
From what you have told me...
Mirmior gazed at the king's maps before him.
The Ningal have tightened their divisions and march with a vanguard of their fiercest warriors. That is good. It means our raids are starting to worry them. But it also means they will be much harder to trap and impossible to ambush from now on.
As if it were not difficult already. I believe our time of nibbling away at our enemy's strength is at an end. Yet we dare not meet them face to face. If we could be assured of fresh troops soon,
I cannot think what we may do. But you are right. We cannot charge them with lances or meet them toe-to-toe as we are often wont to do. I will defer to Mirmior's counsel yet a little longer.
Lords, you flatter me. I have no secrets here, and I freely tell what I know, so that you will know just how perilous is our position. It is very grave for us, my brave friends. I do not see a weakness that we may exploit. They have countered all our tricks this time.
Mirmior looked again at the map, head bent down, eyes red-rimmed from sleepless nights of studying and pondering the movements of the foe, as reported to him by the assembled commanders.
How far are we from this river?
Let me see. This is but a branch of the Arvin, which lies 2 or 3 leagues away to the west. It is not so large as it appears on the map, I assure you.
Nevertheless, I have found a plan which may gain us but a little more time. A very subtle plan.
The cold wind whipping off the sharp snags of rock stung Quentin's face, and the howl deafened him as it ravaged the bare peaks and screamed down into endless, empty places. He kept his cloak turned up to cover his ears and wished that he had brought warmer clothing. Though only 4 days had passed since they had reached the higher elevations of the Fiskills, it now seemed ages since he had felt the warmth of the sun and seen the green of summer-filled hills. In every direction, wherever Quentin turned his eyes, he saw the same thing. An infinite vista of jagged gray and white peaks jutting sharply against a pale blue sky. Each day was much the same, cold and windy without respite. At night, they camped under a star-filled sky on ledges and crevices and fissures out of the wind, but the rock was cold and hard. In the morning, they awoke to the harsh white light of a sun that shed no warmth upon the day, unless by chance they happened to find a spot hidden from the wind where they could stop and eat a bite before continuing. Then Quentin would feel a brief bit of warmth seep into him, tingling on his skin like dancing fire. But those respites were rare and never long enough. For Durwin, sinking more and more into silence and a dour mood, pushed a merciless pace along the crag-bound trails. The party, at first so full of goodwill and high spirits, now dragged along dolefully, each one lost to himself and his own thoughts, their faces as gray and cheerless as the bare rock around them. Quentin's thoughts turned toward Thedo and Ronsard and the battles he imagined they were waging far away. More than once he wished he could be there beside them. Instead of floundering here, lost in a world of dull rock and white light and severe blue sides, as often as not, clouded with gray wispy clouds which shredded themselves on the peaks and spilled a damp chill drizzle to thoroughly quench any spark of hope that they would see the end of their seemingly endless journey. At night he lay awake and watched the dread star bend its fearful beams through the thin air of the high altitudes. It now filled its quadrant with light and was the brightest object in the sky at night, save the moon itself. Quentin even began to believe that the star would grow and grow to consume the heavens and the earth, that it would eventually touch the world and set off the conflagration which would prepare the earth for the new age. These thoughts and others like them filled Quentin with a sense of hopelessness he had never known before. And as the search among the high rocks continued day after day, he began to think that doom was certain, and that it was already too late to forestall the inevitable. One morning, Quentin was shaken out of his gloomy reverie by Tolly, who had gone ahead to check on the trail, which threatened to narrow beyond the ability of horses to maintain their footing.
Quentin! Quentin!
Quentin looked up and saw Tolly, red-faced with excitement and the exertion of running, flying down the rock-strewn path.
Oh, beautiful! Come and see it! A valley! It is wonderful! Come!
Durwin was already toiling up the path behind Tolly, who sprang lightly as a mountain goat over the flat slabs of rock, pointing and waving ecstatically. Quentin turned to look at Inchkeith.
Well, a fair sight would be welcome to these burning eyes, I would reckon, even if it be not our journey's end.
Then by all means, let us view this sight. I would see what would cause such fulsome praise in the ever-quiet Tolly.
Inchkeith turned, ignoring Quentin's comment, and began scuttling over the rock, barely keeping Tolly, now disappearing over the crest, in sight. Quentin glumly fell in and began trudging up the steep path, a narrow cut in the rock formed by a rivulet which carried away the spring melt. By the time he neared the top, none of the others were to be seen. He reached the summit and walked a few paces down the opposite slope before he thought to raise his eyes. The sight before him so stunned Quentin, he sat down. Across a vast and limitless gulf of silver mist, he saw an enormous bowl rimmed around with snowy peaks like white teeth. And the bowl, with gently curving sides, was a scintillating mountain green, all soft and mossy, the color of emeralds when struck by the sunlight. Carving through the center of the beautiful valley in a graceful, sweeping undulation, ran a river, gleaming like molten silver, filling a basin at the near end to form a lake shaped like a spearhead. The lake was deepest blue crystal and reflected the white-capped peaks rimming the fathomless blue sky above. All this Quentin took in moments later. In his first rapturous gaze, all he saw was the awesome splendor of the towering, frothing, magnificent falls which fed the river and formed the lake.
It is the falls of Shaenid Velen, the falls of the Sky Lord's mirror. The lake is the mirror, of course, and Sky Lord is another name among the Auriga for...
Restoran. I know. I have heard of Shaenid Velen, but I never thought...
Yes, it is hard to believe that such beauty still exists in the world of men.
Looking down upon it, Quentin could well believe that the Auriga had once sat where he sat and had seen it as he was seeing it. In that instant, he felt as if the immense barrier of time separating him from that happy time when the Auriga had walked the earth had been rolled aside. Inexplicably, the constant longing for a glimpse of that vanished time was suddenly stilled within his breast. Here it was at last, that which remained from of old, unchanged. The next thing Quentin knew, he was running down the precipitous grade toward the Crystal Lake. It was a tearful farewell with which Alenia sent Escobar to meet the assembled armies of his lords. As much as she wanted to show him a brave front, she could not. In all her life as queen, she had never sent him off with tears in her eyes, no matter how much he might have cried for fear and loneliness later when he had gone. She did not want his last memory of her to be one of sorrow. This time, she could not contain her feelings. The tears welled up from her heart and overflowed to splash down her white cheeks. Escobar, so used to the bold face his wife had always before maintained, seemed bewildered by what he considered a sudden change.
My lady, be not forlorn. I shall return as soon as I may. There's nothing we have not faced before, my love.
I fear it is, my lord.
Alenia dabbed at the corners of her emerald eyes with a bit of lace. The king took the handkerchief from her and poked it down inside his breastplate.
I will keep this near my heart so that I will not forget the tears you shed in my absence. It shall remind me to hurry hence and dry your eyes as soon as may be.
Escobar lifted a gauntleted hand to smooth her auburn hair and looked deeply into her eyes.
This will be the last time, Alenia. I promise you I will never leave you again.
Alenia looked at him, standing in the small courtyard of the inner ward just before the postern gate, and through her tears, it seemed as if the years had been rolled back once more, and the young Dragon King was looking down on her with brightly blazing eyes, eager to be off to defend his realm.
Go, my lord. But do not say it is the last, for I know that you must ever be where harm threatens your kingdom. But go, and with no regret for me. Only promise that you will hasten back when your labors have restored peace to the land.
When she had finished speaking, she threw her arms around his neck and kissed him. He held her stiffly, her soft flesh pressed against his steely armor.
Farewell, my queen.
Alenia turned and hurried away through the small arch door in the wall. Escobar watched her go, and then turned to the warder, who stood with averted eyes, holding the reins of his mount. The warder dashed to the ironclad gate and pushed it open. Outside, the armorer and the king's squires were waiting. Without a word, the king led them through the gatehouse, over the plank, and down the long, winding walled ramp which formed the rear approach to Ascalon. They crossed the dry moat and rode out across the plain to meet the lords of Mensendor and their assembled armies, where they stood amidst fluttering pennons and glinting steel, waiting for their king.
Yonder comes the Dragon King!
Lord Rudd scanned the plain, eyes squinting in the sun.
Sound the call!
Escobar rode into the midst of his army.
Loyal subjects, men of Mancendor, today we march to meet a great and deadly foe. Messages from those already engaged against the enemy indicate that he has reached the borders of Pelgrim Forest, but 10 leagues to the east. In his wake, the enemy has destroyed our towns and villages and has slain the innocent. For Mancendor!
With his sword pointed to the east, Escobar spurred his horse through the assembled armies. Behind him, the way closed as the knights and footmen took up their weapons and followed their king into battle.
This makes the task of getting here worth every step.
Quentin sat on a grassy knob, dabbling his bare feet in the cold, clean water of Shenad Velen.
This is a most fitting reward.
So it is, but we have not yet found the mines, though I believe we are at last at a place to begin looking.
Durwin was bent once more over his maps and scribbles, searching for a clue to a sign which might spark the discovery. Tully strode up, buoyant and brimming with good cheer, fairly intoxicated with the beauty around him.
I have set the horses free to graze. Look at them run!
Indeed, the horses were gambling like colts in the balmy air of the great bowl of a valley.
We shall have a time of it trying to catch them again.
Quentin and Tully looked at each other. Inchkeith had been mumbling darkly ever since they discovered the Enchanted Valley. While their spirits had risen on wings of joy, his seemed to have fallen lower by equal degrees. He was now quite sour.
Do not worry on it, Master Inchkeith. They will come running to Tully's whistle without fail. He has a power over them, you will see.
Now then, listen to me. Here is the riddle once more. Think now. Over tooth and under claw, wend your way with care. Where mountains sleep, sharp vigil keep. You shall see the way most clear. When you hear laughter among the clouds and see a curtain made of glass, take no care for hand nor hair, or you shall surely never pass. Part the curtain, divide the thunder, and seek the narrow way. Give day for night, and withhold the light, and you have won the day. Well, as I thought, it is not so simple now, is it? Now that the time has come to solve the mystery...
Past time, if you ask me. It is folly to roam these wasted rocks chasing a dream. Look at us. We're up here babbling like children over riddles and nonsense. Down there, men are dying. The blood of good men runs hot upon the ground while we potter among the clouds.
Could we serve them better by taking up swords and throwing ourselves into the fight? Would our blades matter very much, do you think?
What does this matter? This riddle-guessing, breaking our bones over these accursed mountains? For what?
I thought you were with us, Inchkeith. I thought you believed as we did in the importance of our journey. You did, I know you did.
Or maybe I did once. But I have had time to think. It was a mistake to come here. I do not belong here. I should be back at my forge and anvil. There is a war on by the gods.
Do not be afraid, Inchkeith. To others it is appointed to fight, and yes, die. To us it is appointed to find the sword and bring it to the king. And if there is even the slightest chance that the sword will be the Jalikir, I believe our efforts could not be better spent than in searching for it, though the whole world weighed in blood.
Do not be afraid. The word struck deep into Quentin's heart. Yes, that was it. Inchkeith was afraid of failing. Perhaps he was even more afraid of succeeding and forging the legend-bound sword, afraid of believing the prophecy could come true. Better for him not to put it to the test. And this was the way of Quentin's heart as well. Although the words had been meant for Inchkeith, they stirred in Quentin a peculiar swirl of emotions. He wanted, all at once, to scream at Durwin.
Why should I not be afraid? I have every good reason. I never asked to be this new king upon whose shoulders the world will rest. I never wanted it.
But Quentin said nothing. He turned his face away and looked out across the sparkling water of the Sky Lord's Mirror. That night, they camped beside the lake, the white-topped peaks to the east glowing rosily across the green bowl, which was now immersed in shadows of deepest indigo. The Wolf Star burned fiercely in the sky and was reflected in the crystalline depths of Shenet Velen. Quentin sat alone, silent, brooding.
So it is. You have come to it at last.
Quentin regarded Derwin with a questioning glance. Gathering his robes, Derwin squatted down beside him.
You have come to that dark and narrow place through which every servant of the Most High must pass.
I do not know what I have come to.
Oh, yes, you do. And that is what is bothering you. It has been gnawing at you ever since we left Ascalon. It was worrying you that night in Inkeith's. I saw it then most clearly. I even spoke to you of it, but you evaded my question.
Is it not possible that we may all be wrong about this prophecy? If you ask me, I'm not the one. And if I were, would I not know it somehow?
Yes. Perhaps we are mistaken. It is possible we have misread the signs. But whether you are the one or no does not matter very much.
Quentin cocked his head sharply. He had not expected the hermit to say that.
No. What does matter is whether you are willing to follow the Most High, even in your unbelief.
I do not know what you mean.
Certainly you do. All your life you have served the gods in one way or another. Of the old gods you soon learned only to demand those things which they were capable of providing, an insignificant sign or two, or a small favor vaguely asked. Then you met Wistoran, the Most High God, the one true God of all. You have served him faithfully these many years and have learned much about his ways. But now is the first time you have ever really had to trust in him, to place yourself totally at his will. And you are afraid.
I am not afraid.
Yes, afraid. You must now put your faith to the test, and such a test, with lost minds and flaming swords and prophecies fulfilled.
Why should I fear that?
The reason is not so hard to guess. It is the same with every man. You fear testing your faith because it means testing the Most High. Deep in your heart, you fear he will fail. If he fails, you are utterly alone in this world and beyond. There is nothing you can believe in anymore.
No, Derwin. That is not my fear.
Tell me then.
I am afraid of being the priest king. I cannot say why. But the mere mention of swords and mines fills me with dread. Look at my arm. How can I wield the Shining One with one arm as dead as firewood?
It is the same thing in the end, is it not? You fear to accept something the Most High has chosen for you.
How is that the same thing?
Most assuredly it is. To accept the crown of Priest King would mean placing your trust totally in the Most High. It means that you must trust him to know what is best for you, to know you better than you know yourself. It would mean trusting him beyond all trust, even when the way is unclear, especially when the way is unclear. When you trust like that, you necessarily test the God's ability to hold you and keep you. You are. We all are unwilling to make such demands of our gods. If we trust but little, we will be disappointed but little, eh?
If I do not believe, but follow anyway, does that not mock the Most High and defeat his will?
No, on the contrary, my friend. To follow without seeing the end in unbelief, as you say, is really the highest form of trust.
It is but blind trust.
Not blind trust. Not at all. Those who trust the powerless gods of earth and sky, they trust blindly. Quentin, look at me. You cannot serve the Most High without trusting him totally. For there always comes a time when he will put you to the test. He will have all of you or nothing at all. There can be no middle ground. It is a demand that he makes of his followers.
see it this way. Why should you be afraid to test the Most High? He invites it. You see your injured arm as proof against his will. Cannot the one who created bones also heal them? If he chooses to raise an orphan acolyte to the crown of the realm, what is to stop him?
You mean that I should go along with this strange business, regardless of my own feelings about it?
Exactly. Do not seek to hide your doubts and fears, or mask them in any way. Give them to him. Let him take them. They are, after all, part of you.
What did you mean earlier, when you told Inkeith not to be afraid?
More or less what I am telling you now. We must not fear for the Most High. He can take care of himself. We must only look to ourselves that we remain faithful to his call. I know it is much to think about in one piece. It has taken me many years to understand these things, and I am asking you to comprehend them in but a few moments. Inkeith does not know the Most High, but he is not an ignorant man. He still feels the fear of believing that something so good and so powerful can exist. And that, as I said before, is the place where most men run aside. But if you go beyond your fears and doubts, and follow anyway, strange and wonderful things can happen. Yes, orphans can become kings, swords can sprout flames, and great enemies can be laid low at a stroke.
Quentin did not hear when Derwin left him, so lost in thought was he. But upon looking up into the night sky, now alive with blazing stars, he knew he was alone. His thoughts roiled and swarmed inside him, and rather than soothing his troubled spirit, Derwin's words had only served to increase the confusion, or so it seemed. Quentin lay down and wrapped himself in his cloak to watch the glittering stars and to ponder the words of the hermit. He lay for a long time thinking, and then slowly drifted into a troubled sleep. As he lay beside the glass smooth shannon Valen, he dreamed a dream filled with things both strange and wonderful. The muddy little tributary, which Mirmior had indicated on the map, lay across the path of the advancing Ningal. It was, as Thedo had advised, not a particularly large stream, but it was deep and lay below steep, root-bound banks in a most dense part of Pelgrin. If anyone ever spoke of it at all, it was called Diorkenril, because of the air of darkness and gloom which surrounded it. Its gray and turgid water slid quietly along a serpentine course through noisome bogs and stagnant pools full of various unsavories, until at last it emptied into the mighty Arvin, many leagues to the north. As unwholesome as it was, it was at this very place that Mirmior proposed that the army of the Dragon King make a final stand to try and halt the invaders' inexorable drive toward Ascalon. The plan was simple, designed to separate the amassed Ningal into smaller groups which could be battled more effectively by the defenders. But like most stratagems of war, Mirmior's plan was not without its element of risk. The weary defenders closed their eyes to the danger, thinking that as it was likely to be their last hope of stopping the Ningal before they reached the plains of Ascalon, no risk was too great. For many leagues to the north and south, there was only one fit place for an army to cross Diorkenril, a hollow at the bottom of a slight hill where the stream flattened out slightly to form a natural ford.
This is better than I could have hoped. It was made for our purpose.
Thedo looked towards Mirmior, silhouetted in the dying light of the gathering dusk.
Well, it is not a place where I would willingly choose to do battle. Let us hope that the Ningal think the same and do not suspect an ambush here.
They have become wary indeed. Their scouts now push far afield and ahead of the main body and are harder to elude. And Thedo is right. This is no place to do battle. Look around you. Mud, trees, vines. Man can hardly draw his sword.
Brave sirs, that is precisely why this place is best suited for us. Whether they suspect or no, they must cross this water. I propose to make it as difficult as possible. But we must get busy. There is much to be done before first light tomorrow. We will need to work through the night.
Very well. We have had our say, and we have no better plan. We put ourselves at your command. What will you have us do?
Mirmior looked around him in the misty twilight. A malodorous vapor was rising from the swampy dingles along Diorkenril's banks to drift slowly among the gray boles of trees.
There! We will begin by opening a channel into the hollow. We will fill it tonight and drain it in the morning. The mud should be very thick by then. And have some men start carrying water to the far bank. I would have that slippery with mud as well.
And so they began. Lily had come unprepared for excavating and carrying water. The Dragon King's forces turned whatever implements they had to the task. Knights, more at home on horseback than on firm ground, slogged tirelessly through mud and stinking water, digging with their noble swords or with bare hands, cutting a channel to bring water to the hollow. They worked by the glimmering of torches. Others climbed the taller trees along either side of the bank and began building platforms of branches and limbs from which archers could rain arrows down upon the enemy. Ropes were wound with vines and stretched from one tree to another. And for Mirmior's supreme surprise, three of the largest trees growing at the edge of the near bank were chopped to within inches of falling, and their upper branches were tied with ropes to other nearby trees to support them. Then the axe marks were covered over and filled in with mud and leaves.